Breaking news on RT. Ex-tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky.
Михаил Ходорковский освобожден от дальнейшего отбывания наказания. Об этом агентство.
Suddenly pardoned him.
He has just moments ago been released from prison.
Вот-вот освободят, так положено по закону.
It caused Russian markets to rally. It's been called a landmark event and a development of colossal significance. And it happened so fast. Well, I had to entirely change my plans for this podcast. It, of course, is the sudden release of jailed former oil executive Mikhail Khodorkovsky after more than a decade as Russia's most famous political prisoner. Khodorkovsky was freed on Friday, just hours after formally receiving a pardon from President Vladimir Putin. So I guess we all know what we'll be discussing today. Hello from our studios in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me via Skype from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And also on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
Well, the Khodorkovsky story, of course, is very, very fluid and is developing even as we record this program. The latest reports have him en route to Germany, for example, but we're waiting for final confirmation and all of that. But nevertheless, this is all happening in an unmistakable context. The Khodorkovsky release, of course, comes in the wake of the amnesties for jailed Pussy Riot members Nadezhda Telekonikova and Maria Lokina, the 30-member crew of the Greenpeace protest ship, and some of the defendants in the Bolotnaya case. So a bid to dampen criticism ahead of the Sochi Olympics, an effort to keep his opponents off balance, a sign that Putin feels strong and no longer sees Khodorkovsky as a threat, all of the above, none of the above, something else. Mark, what are your thoughts?
I think I'll tick the all of the above with a little bit extra.
Okay.
box, actually. I mean, I think, you know, you're absolutely right. The context is indeed all. And therefore, I think it's worth thinking along four lines of context. I mean, very briefly, Putin has once again reasserted the patrimonial czarist sort of style of rule. That, you know, he reaches down and provides clemency whenever he wants to, the same way as he sort of fixes your local sanitation problems in, you know, some small town out in the middle of Siberia or whatever. So it's once again showing his own sort of dominance and his own confidence, I think it's meant to be. Secondly, the geopolitical dimension, exactly. There's this funny sort of hot and cold, Mr. Nice, Mr. Nasty sort of almost charm offensive, but with a considerable degree of lack of charm, that's currently being waged. So on the one hand, they're eliminating Rianovosti and so forth, and at the same time, they're doing something like this. Again, I think it's meant to sort of basically build a few bridges maybe before Sochi, and also keep the outside world guessing. Third context in terms of opposition politics. You know, is Khodorkovsky going to get involved directly in politics within Russia? I mean, he may currently be on his way to Germany, you know. Is that it? Has he abandoned the motherland, or will he be returning? And if so, what's this going to mean for an opposition movement that up to now has been dominated by a single figure, Navalny, who doesn't seem to be a team player, who doesn't seem to look as if he's looking for a biumvirate?
Right.
And the final context is actually Khodorkovsky himself. I mean, I think the interesting thing is we don't know what his plans are. You know, is he going to become one more, you know, able to be characterized as one more embittered émigré oligarch inveighing against Putin from a comfortable home somewhere in the West? Is he just going to try and put this all behind him? Is he going to try and get involved directly in Russian politics? We wait and see.
Yeah, there certainly are more questions than answers right now. Kirill, what are your thoughts?
Oh, first of all, of course, I'd like to follow Mark's idea to focus on several contexts of this situation. First context is, yeah, I agree totally, it's Putin and his role and his position now, especially before the Olympic Games. And I think the main reason of Khodorkovsky's release is that he's trying to start a sort of a new political season in Russia, which will consist of Olympic Games, political reforms. Some of them, they're still...
Again,
know,
we're going to have the ghost of political reforms returning,
yes,
to...
Yes, but it's going. Yes, actually, today that was, you know, a very small interest to this news. But anyway, Mikhail Prokhorov informed that his sister Irina Prokhorova will be a leader of Гражданская платформа, civil platform, political party. It's one of the, you know, very small signs of the beginning of this new political.
Mm-hmm. Okay, on Ходорковский though.
Going back to Ходорковский. Yes, the most interesting thing it's a reaction of Russian opposition, Russian, you know, society, which you can find, you know, on Facebook and so on. Right? A lot of speculation, a lot of, you know, historical and literature analogies. He was compared to Solzhenitsyn already because he's going to Germany. Yes, by the way, just now, German government confirmed that he is going to Berlin. Mm-hmm. Second comparison is to Sakharov, of course. The third one I read, very exotic, like, you know, Count Monte Cristo. By the way, who's Abbot Farah in this case? And so on. I'm not sure that he will play, you know, a role of or game of, you know, another one oligarch who's sitting in, say, Germany or something like this and trying to be a new Alexander Ivanovich Gerson. I think he will return to Russia. Mm. He will settle there. He will establish some of, you know, civil, not political, but civil foundation. And I think he is rather clever to keep distance for some time from, you know, hot politics.
Well, I don't think he has a lot of choice in that. I mean, he certainly can't run for office because my understanding of this pardon frees him from his sentence, but it does not expunge his record. So yeah. he's still, according to existing Russian legislation, would be barred from running for political office, at least in my understanding. Anybody feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. One of the things that's floating out there right now is that there was some kind of a deal that he would be pardoned if he kept quiet and perhaps left the country or at least until the Sochi Olympics. Because I can't really imagine Putin releasing Ходорковский to, you know, have a Navalny-like triumphant return to Moscow in the and then to be running around free in the kingdom during Putin's show in Sochi. Mark, what do you think? Was there a deal here?
Well, I doubt there's an explicit deal, if nothing else, because let's face it, these deals are meaningless. They are agreements, and then, you know, how do you ever actually enforce it? The real essence of the deal is I would suggest, tacit. You know, although Putin sort of backpedaled slightly from any thought of there being a new Ходорковский trial, you know, we all know full well that he can pull out a charge out of his back pocket any time he wants to. And, you know, Ходорковский knows that perfectly well, too. So, I mean, my expectation is that there is a sort of degree of kind of, you know, nod and a wink understanding that if he tries immediately to exactly, you know, stage some triumphant return, really embarrass the Kremlin dramatically or whatever, then, you know, the Kremlin can do things back at him, particularly if, I mean, you know, before the actual podcast we were talking, I mean, Kirill was saying that his mother is still in Moscow. Yeah. And again, I mean, it's not actually that I think that some FSB officer would have sidled up to him and said, you know, remember, your mother still can't fly or whatever. But in some things, there are some things that don't need to be said.
Yeah. No, Kirill, what do you think? A deal or no? Or do you...
Of course. Yes, of course. No one knows what was behind, you know, this release, and I doubt that we will know about this something. But anyway, I'm not against. So I'm not in the position, you know, to be against or pro something. But anyway, such deals is, you know, they are part of politics. You know, both of them, Putin and Ходорковский, they are politicians, and this is a very, you know, legal tool or instrument in, you know, such field of human activity. And so it's normal. It's normal, especially in such, you know, far from normal political life in Russia. So that's I think it's just a positive thing for both of the parts of this, you know, political game today. So that's why you can't find, you know, any serious political or cultural figure who, you know, will oppose the release of Ходорковский today. Whoever he will be, you know, from, you know, some supporters of Putin or some from opposition side and so on, all of them, they will say that, oh, it's okay, it's a very good thing. That's why I think Putin won this particular situation, because no one is against this.
Right. Now, there's another thing, Mark, we were talking off mic a bit about what the effect this might have on the opposition. And again, we don't know where Hodorkovsky's going to end up as we're speaking. As people may be listening to this podcast, this may have become a bit clearer. But as it looks right now, we have reports that Hodorkovsky's on his way to Germany. The German government has apparently confirmed those reports. It's unclear whether this is a temporary thing to because his mother is to, for his mother to get treatment in Germany, or something else. The situation is very fluid as we speak. But leaving all that aside, the effect of this on the opposition, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, again, unfortunately, here we are obviously piling supposition on supposition,
which we have no choice but to do at
absolutely.
This point.
So, I mean, accepting the notion that he does return to Russia, because I think it's very, I mean, if he's not, I think his scope is going to be very, very limited. Yes. And to be honest, he will become quite a toxic brand if he's not in Russia, because, you know, you think with the sort of current pressure on, you know, foreign agents and everything else, if he's simply trying to funnel money and support to others in Russia doing his work, that's going to be problematic. So really, he needs to be in Russia if he wants to be an active political figure. And even if he does set up, you know, try and operate through, you know, civil rather than political foundations and such like, in Russia, everything is political. I mean, mm-hmm. it very much, sort of very quickly becomes identified as such. Well, I mean, then the question becomes, how comfortable would he be, for example, working with a Navalny? And this might be one of the key things that actually starts to tease out what Navalny stands for. You know, how deep, how important, for example, is his nationalism to his overall political vision? You know, it's easy to sort of talk about the anti-corruption. Everyone's against corruption. I haven't said Putin's against corruption, or so he says. Though I don't think he'll be voting for Navalny any day now. But you know, it begins to actually force Navalny to actually start to deal with someone as something like an equal, which is not something he's had to do. You know, we currently have an opposition movement with a leader really by default, more than anything else. Hodorkovsky would come in, and he's a very, very different figure. I mean, on the one hand, he clearly has particular resources of his own. He has, a background that is a vulnerability as an oligarch, you know, who are regarded as a sort of, in the 1990s, oligarchs are rightly regarded as exploitative parasites. But on the other hand, he has had his redemptive time in prison to shed that, and therefore I think that's quite a powerful political narrative.
The halo of 10 years in prison overshadows the halo of, what was it, I don't know how many days Navalny spent in prison, but yes.
Exactly. But I mean, the thing too is basically, what does Hodorkovsky want? If he wants to be, if not the leader, but, you know, in a leadership position within a movement, then he's going to have to work out if he can work with Navalny or not. Right. Sure, they can reach coalitions and alliances, but we've seen that doesn't tend to work.
And Navalny himself is, and I wanted to go to talk to Kirill's thoughts on this as well, is that Navalny in prison wrote this manifesto, or he's kind of had this epiphany, and he is now kind of a leftist, so to speak, for lack of a better word, something of a socialist, and is concerned with issues of social justice, which puts him on the opposite side of the political spectrum as Navalny. Now, Navalny himself has said he was fine working with Udaltsov, who is, you know, even more left than Hodorkovsky is professing to be now. Kirill, what about that? Hodorkovsky's positioning himself as kind of a figure on the left who's had this kind of conversion. Do you expect to see a continuation of this?
Of course, I can just speculate about all
these
things.
That's all we can do.
Yes, and I think there are several possibilities. The first one is that maybe, I don't know, but maybe Putin tries to divide Russian opposition between so-called traditional liberals, which are, of course, supporting Hodorkovsky much more than Navalny. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And other side, it's a sort of, you know, new opposition, mm-hmm. which is not, you know, such liberal, yes, maybe more nationalistic, more, you know, active anyway, more active, less established in so-called Moscow society, which are supporters of Navalny. Maybe it's a part of some plan, Jesuitic plan, to divide the Russian opposition. And I just mentioned about Гражданская платформа, Civil Platform mm-hmm. Party. It's another one, you know, possibility for Russian liberals to support, you know, in a new political. I think you hit on something actually pretty important here:
the new and the old opposition. Yeah. Because I think if you look at Khodorkovsky and Navalny, for example, you have the kind of the it is the divide between the new and the old opposition, so to speak, in some ways. What about that, Mark? Is this can we make a generation? Or Kirill, you wanted to say something?
Yes, just another one possibility is that there will be, you know, some sort of, you know, it's not a division, but maybe some of, you know, structure or structural change in the Russian opposition, in which Navalny will be, you know, a real actual political leader, and Khodorkovsky would be, you know, some kind of moral authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and in this case, it doesn't matter where he lives. He can live, you know, in Switzerland. By the way, just new information that after Berlin, he will go to Switzerland. It's absolutely like
this is happening in real time.
Yes,
and by the time everybody listens to it, they'll know more than we know now.
Yes, and maybe this, you know, possibility will be more, you know, really interesting. I don't know.
Mark, what do you think about this splitting the old and the new opposition, or maybe Khodorkovsky becoming this kind of elder statesman moral authority figure? Would you...
Yes, I mean, difficult at the moment. I'm slightly distracted by the prospect of a sort of a State Department-funded sealed train bringing Khodorkovsky back to Russia from Switzerland. But anyway, I mean... I very much agree that it raises this interesting question of the split between the sort of, as it were, old and new opposition. There is a problem, because old opposition again implies something about it being sort of, you know, faded and shabby. But another way of looking at it actually is the potential for a split between a positive and a negative opposition. In the, you know, again, you know, Khodorkovsky has presented this sense of a manifesto. He and the kind of the movements and the people who have already cohered around him or around the idea of Khodorkovsky, which is every bit as powerful,
right,
actually sort of seem to have much more of a programmatic sense of what they want to see in Russia. Whereas we still haven't really seen that with Navalny. With Navalny, we still have essentially an opposition against corruption, against the current state system and so forth. So, you know, and until we get that teased out, although, yes, of course, there is a possibility that they could perform this role of the, you know, the godfather from abroad and the active political operator on the ground. But we still really aren't in a position to actually say whether there's likely to be any great overlap. I mean, beyond disliking the current regime and what the regime stands for, what else do they have in common? That waits to be seen.
Now, there's another element to this as well, and that is that perhaps this is just a sign that Putin feels so strong that he's just not threatened by Khodorkovsky anymore. Or, in a related sense, that Khodorkovsky, the idea, as Mark, you so aptly put it, was very potent when he is in prison. But out of prison, is it so potent anymore?
I think that this is the sign, I agree, that Putin feels himself very strong. But he feels, you know, it's a subjective point of view, not objective,
mm-hmm.
because he could release Khodorkovsky 1 year ago, or 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, and so on. So the question is not how he, you know, how does he feel now, but why now? Why, you know, these particular days of the in the end of December 2013? And I think if we want to understand the political logic in, you know, recent Russian situation, the most interesting thing is to discuss the exact date of this release and all this, you know,
Dien Chakistov. You mean it happened on KGB days? Today is Dien Chakistov.
I'm speaking about real situation. So we forgot another one very important thing. It's upcoming economic difficulties in Russia. I'm not speaking about crisis, yeah, but it's difficulties. And for the last, you know, week, I read a lot of publications. Very interesting, by the way, blog on the Russian Forbes website about real economic situation in Russia. So, of course, Putin is trying to transform the political system and even the ideological climate in Russia, in some sense preparing referring to, you know, the future economic difficulties and, you know, the worsened political situation, I think so.
And also, before we move on to the next segment, when we will discuss some ideological things, we have to be again reminded of the context. This is happening this weekend. Telekonikova and Alukin are expected to be released, if I understand the situation properly. The Greenpeace, the 30-member crew of the Greenpeace protest ship were amnestied, and some defendants in the Bolotnaya case were amnestied as well. Is Putin trying to turn the page here?
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, let me put it this way. No, neither would I. I certainly don't see this actually as a sign of Putin's strength. One thing we have not seen is Putin being magnanimous in victory. Instead, I think it reflects an attempt to precisely eliminate or reduce points of irritation, points of vulnerability, whether it's with the outside world or whether it's domestically. And a recognition that, you might say, you don't have to be strong to recognize that actually people you have in prison may not be that important themselves. You know, Pussy Riot was important only because of the trial. And by kicking them out of prison, frankly, you're not empowering anyone. Khodorkovsky, likewise, actually, arguably, as a person, he is going to be less powerful than as a figure in prison. You know, the iconic political prisoner, basically, of the Putin years. I think for all these reasons, in some ways, I think he's trying to simplify the process. And here, I think Kirill is absolutely spot on, that it's because there is this understanding in the Kremlin that there is this great wave of economic problems that will be crashing on them. And therefore, it's, well, you know, do you really want to be messing around with some of these petty issues? You want to deal with what's important. And I think that's the case. I think it's more it's part of the Kremlin preparing itself for bad times ahead.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, this story will continue to develop, and we will be following it. It'll give us plenty of things to talk about in future podcasts. But as of right now, we have more questions than answers. In a few moments, we will shift gears and look at another story making waves: Vladimir Putin's quixotic bid to become the leader of the world's conservatives. I'd like to remind you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me via Skype from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. And also on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Россия – страна с очень древней, глубокой культурой. Без этих ценностей общество деградирует. Понятные, по сути, квазирелигиозные ценности.
Конечно,
консервативный подход.
Но это консерватизм или консерватизм – это то не мешает
от достаточно агрессивного поведения. Не убей, не укради,
не пожелай же. It seems there was a method to the madness after all. The Pussy Riot trial, the appointment of the nationalistic Vladimir Medinsky as culture minister, laws banning so-called gay propaganda, a prohibition on blasphemy, and the appointment of a firebrand television anchor to head the Kremlin's massive new media conglomerate. The pattern's been clear for years. The purpose, well, not so much, at least not until now. Just days before Vladimir Putin gave a full-throated defense of Russia's traditional values and derided the West's, quote, genderless and infertile liberalism in his State of the Nation address, a Kremlin-connected think tank called the Center for Strategic Communications unveiled a new report. The title? Putin, World Conservatism's New Leader. According to the report, most people around the globe yearn for stability and security, favor traditional family values over feminism and LGBT rights, and prefer nation-based states rather than multicultural melting pots. Putin, the report says, stands for these values, while the, quote, ideological populism of the left in the West is, quote, dividing society. The conventional wisdom has been that the xenophobia, homophobia, and nationalism emanating from the Kremlin has been mainly for domestic consumption. But now it seems that Putin is also aiming at a global audience. The Kremlin apparently believes it's found the ultimate wedge issue, one that will unite its supporters and divide its opponents, both in Russia and the West. One that will garner support in the developing world, and one that will help return Russia to its rightful place as a great power with a messianic mission and the ability to win hearts and minds globally. So, Vladimir Putin at the vanguard of the conservative international. What do you think, Mark? Will this fly? Will this dog hunt, so to speak?
Well, I think we've got a whole pack of dogs here, and although there's certainly going to be lots of barking, I think one of them is likely to actually sort of bring home something for the table. I mean, I think we need to look at this as both external and internal. I mean, I think externally, there is a fascinating conceit with this. I mean, you played on the blog with the idea of the parallels with Lenin and the Third International, and the idea of a con intern is tempting. But I mean, I think, to be honest, soft power of that kind is really, really central to the Kremlin's effectiveness geopolitically. Yes, it can help people think, look, at least here is a great power that is standing up for traditional values and so forth. And it means you can get Pat Buchanan praising you for your moral clarity. But in practice, the Kremlin's diplomacy is based around dealing with cynical autocrats and dealing with gullible Democrats. It's a leadership-based diplomacy. It doesn't really reach out to people, even with the glorious technicolor antics of RT and other instruments of Russian soft power. It's hard to really see that it has a strong impact. So, again, externally, a lot of barking. It helps in some ways, I think, regimes rationalize dealings that they do with the Kremlin. I mean, if you think of Ukraine, I mean, there was a case in which actually, it wasn't at all to do with the European Union's stance on homosexuality or whatever. But that was just simply a way of trying to sell a decision that was made in a cynical circle of elites.
But they used this prior to Ukraine making its final decision. They tried to use this to affect public opinion and elite opinion in Ukraine.
I'm unconvinced that it actually has a great deal of traction with constituencies that are going to swing. I mean, it plays to constituencies that anyway were looking to a certain form of politics, in my opinion. But I think it's domestically that this is going to, again, have a particular impact. And again, we can link this in with this whole sense of the Kremlin beginning to build up its walls. In the sense that there has always been, and I'm always worried about sort of this kind of cultural relativism, but nonetheless, I think it's a long strand of Russian sense of defensiveness, even in security, compared with the advanced quote unquote countries. Now that's whether we're talking about Tsarist aristocrats aping Russian court manners onwards. And I think a way of trying to say, look, we are actually, in some ways, we are at the vanguard. We are espousing values which are traditional, but again, have been lost. And even people in the West are coming to realize that. I think that's something that is intended to play domestically.
So you see, because I see the new thing here, the domestic thing. We basically all get this. We've seen this, how this plays out domestically, how it works domestically, and how it's relatively successful domestically. But the new thing I saw here was this effort to drive a wedge in the West, much like, as I pointed out in the blog, the Soviet Union's communist rulers did, using progressive elements in the West who may not be communist, but who favored a softer line towards Russia, who are more accommodating towards Russia. This worked in society and in elites. You wonder if this isn't what their game is right now. I mean, if you have, think of what this is doing. Okay, we mentioned Patrick Buchanan wrote an op-ed praising Putin's speech and saying maybe he's one of us, meaning maybe he's a conservative. He seems to be making a lot of sense here. There's other conservative thinkers in the U.S. and in Europe have done the same. Now, traditionally, the right has been those ones that favor a tougher line with Moscow. If you split that, doesn't that give you some kind of geopolitical advantage?
If that's what really happens, that's fair enough. I mean, look, obviously the Kremlin will be happy for everything it gets. I think when it comes down to it, though, I think it actually what really matters to the Kremlin is domestic. And I think the thought of saying, well, look, Russian state-appointed TV person says Putin is doing the right thing. That's not news. Important foreign dignitary says Russia and Putin are doing the right thing. That actually has a certain degree of potential impact, I think, domestically. Of course, as I said, I mean, any wedge issue is great. But this is, that's frankly not new. Putin has tried all kinds of ways. I mean, the same way as he's played the we must be aware of American unipolarity as a card with China, as a card with India and so forth. Yeah, I mean, obviously the Russians will look to every single wedge issue, and this is one more in the arsenal. But I don't think it's as important externally.
Now, one thing I would add, though, is that the Comintern and its successors were just one part of the Soviet foreign policy arsenal, just one that they used to divide and to divide the West and to further advance their geopolitical aims. And I expect this to be just one part of Putin's arsenal, although it appears right now to be a new part. Kirill, what do you think?
When Putin speaks about, you know, so-called modern conservatism and so on, he cannot understand that there is no such thing as, you know, universal conservative.
No, but he's speaking to a specific strand of it that does resonate. I mean, he's speaking about traditional family values, what we would call in the West social conservatism.
Yes.
And this is it exists everywhere. You find it. You'll find it in Western Europe. You'll find it in the United States. You will certainly find it in the developing world. So I think he is speaking to something. No, it's not a doctrinaire position that's laid out in a series of texts written by Karl Marx or in this case a conservative thinker. But it is something that is shared, that is widely shared around the world.
Social conservatism is not universal in the modern world. Social conservatism in the United States and, say, India is absolutely different. So-called family values and so on, they are absolutely different, say, between, you know, Netherlands and Burma, or, you know, Uzbekistan and so on. When we speak about some, you know, conservatives who are defending their traditional values in the same Netherlands, like, you know, all this anti-immigrant movement in this country, it's a huge difference even between them and, say, social conservatives in France, which are supporting so-called traditional values in France. You know, Marine Le Pen and Wilders, they're absolutely different.
Perhaps so.
Figures.
Perhaps
yes.
So. But let's take just the one plank of all of this that Putin has chosen and his surrogates have chosen to push, and that is opposition to LGBT rights. That is going to have, among certain quarters in France, even the Netherlands, certainly the U.S., the developing world, is going to have some kind of resonance. So as a wedge, doesn't it work? Whether we agree with it or not, and that is certainly is entirely beside, is it effective?
I am very skeptical about the very existence of this, you know, huge audience of such ideas and so on, because social conservatism in opposite to, you know, some revolutionary or progressive ideas, usually it's very pragmatic. It's all about tradition, and tradition couldn't be, you know, spoken, some, you know, in the many ways. And so there are tens and tens, you know, brilliant conservative thinkers in 19th century and even in 20th century, but they are not, you know, such popular. They're all about, it's you know, all this stuff from Joseph de Maistre to, you know, to conservatives in 20th century. It's an elitist thing. Social conservatism as an idea is a very elitist thing.
Which plays with very populist themes.
Yes, yes. But it couldn't be any, you know, just substitute for ideology. So it couldn't be. I don't believe in the very existence of such, you know, huge audience for such ideas and so on. Because, of course, people all over the world, they use, it's very good, that they used to live in the way they used to live. That's all, you know, that's the whole definition of all this conservative idea. They used to live the way how they used to live. That's all. Nothing to discuss.
Now,
nothing to, you know, to promote.
On one hand, I've kind of gone through different thoughts on this. On one hand, as I wrote on the blog, this does this effort, does kind of fit into the concept of what Nikolai Berdyaev called the old Russian messianic idea, you know, from the Third Rome to autocracy, orthodoxy, nationality, to the Third International, so to speak. This is a strand that runs through Russian history, this kind of messianism. On the other hand, ideology in Russia has often been nothing more than a smokescreen, and critics say, and I've been among them often, that the country is a kleptocracy in search of an ideology. Mark, what do you think? Which it could be both. What do you think? You're going to say both.
Well, no, I mean, let me just first of all start by, now that Kirill and I have taken your original idea and given it a damn good kicking, to try and sort of, you know, resuscitate part of it. I mean, yes, there is clearly an attempt by the sort of, the current regime to present itself as having something to say to the global population, to the global, add to the global conversation. And in some ways, I mean, it's perverse, but if I can link it to a recent pronouncement by one of my favorite Russian politicians, who is Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin, with his call for a Russian moon base. And God love you, Dmitry. And in a way, they're trying to present themselves as being, shall we say, sort of technologically modern and socially conservative, and trying to say that you can actually sort of maintain the balance. Of course, the irony is, in fact, that Russia is actually the opposite. It is technologically backward in many ways, and actually, in terms of the society, socially quite progressive in many ways, certainly in global terms. I mean, I think we have to realize this. You know, if Russia wants to try and use this as a wedge issue, Russia's going to have to cope with the fact that it's actually talking to populations who, in many cases, are far, far more retrograde. You know, wow. So Russia passes a law criminalizing sort of, gay propaganda, how it's defined. Well, and, not in any way wanting to defend or minimize that. But, you compare that to the vast swaths of the world in which actually homosexuality is illegal, full stop. Hmm. In that context, actually, Russia cannot really present itself as being the tribune of their values when it is already so far beyond them. So, I mean, I think that for me, this is more... it is sort of not so much messianism, because again, which that goes back to Kirill's point, it implies some kind of a program. It is much more, I mean, I'm glad you raised the, autocracy, orthodoxy, nationalism point, because that was one of the classic, wonderful, meaningless slogans that mainly said, look, we want to really keep what we've got, we want to emphasize certain bits of it. But essentially, these are not so much a mission statement as just a sort of a set of ideological knee-jerk reactions. That's where Russia is. That's where Putin is. I think he's casting out these notions and hoping that gullible, useful idiots, both at home and abroad, are going to think that somehow means that Putin's one of us. Putin is not Pat Buchanan. Putin would not really fit into the Tea Party, especially with the Tea Party's abhorrence of big government. Nor is actually Putin a conservative when viewed from the point of view of India or large parts of the developing world and so forth. Putin is Putin. He is in many ways kind of Homo Sovieticus meets kleptocrat. But the point is that if he can create these general sort of random buzzwords and everyone else can happily populate them with meanings that suit them, he's happy with that. I mean, that's definitely mm-hmm. a plus. In that respect, I mean, it is.
Does that have a geopolitical advantage? Issue.
Yeah, it has an advantage, but all I'm saying is I don't think it's a big one. It's every little advantage helps, but internationally, I really don't think it's a particularly major swing issue.
Now, another thing that and then this takes away from my argument a bit, though, is that the Soviet Union spent a lot of resources building the infrastructure to kind of push its to promote its values among progressives, again, who may or may not be communists in the West. They spent a lot of money setting up, as Nina Khrushcheva pointed out on the podcast last week when we had a brief discussion about this. There's no indication outside of a few things like RT, the Valdai discussion group, and in the Dialogue of Civilizations, that they're going to be doing that this time, although the creation of Rossiya Sovetnya and the appointment of Kisilyov has made a lot of people to start to think maybe this is where they start really, really doing it, no?
Well, I mean, the point is that there's a huge difference between having a glitzy TV and radio production center. And let's face it, you know, the Russia Today thing is just simply going to be rebranded and possibly actually cut down and therefore made cheaper. That's a world apart from building dams and hospitals. Mm-hmm. And whatever else you may feel, and the Soviets weren't doing it out of pure altruism, but nor were they doing it purely out of geopolitics. I mean, I think there was an extent to which actually the Soviet leadership believed in some of its nonsense. But the point is, they did. You know, if you look at Afghanistan today, there's still hospitals and other sort of, you know, roads and so forth that were built by the Soviets. And it wasn't just purely once they'd invaded so that they could move their troops around. That I don't see Russia being willing or indeed able to do. A TV station is relatively cheap compared with building dams. Mm.
Kirill?
I absolutely agree with Mark. You can sell something progressive in the modern world, but not something conservative. You can sell something, you know, high-tech in modern world, or some, you know, connected to humanism, anthropology, anthropocentral things. So something which, you know, which cannot connect you to ordinary people with their thoughts about future, bright future of their own, of their children, and so on. You can't sell the idea that we must live, you know, this way in which, you know, our grandparents lived, you know, 100 years ago. It's firstly. Secondly, I was watching the attempt to establish a sort of, you know, organizations promoting some, you know, some Russianness abroad from the very beginning of 2000s. It's a system of so-called Russian houses, Ruskiy Dom, mm-hmm. Which they established, as far as I remember, in the very beginning of 2003 or something like this. And Putin's wife, Lyudmila, she was, you know, a sort of chief there. And they tried to
Putin's copy. Ex-wife.
Yeah. Ex-wife, yes. So we're speaking about family values. Yeah. And they tried to copy their activity of a French Institute or Goethe Institute mm-hmm. or British Council mm-hmm. and so on. It's very interesting how any Russian traditionalist, mm-hmm. Conservative step is copying something which is, you know, absolutely foreign. it's true, yeah. And French Institute, as all of us know, it's quite successful. Why? Because it's selling the very progressive, you know, in modern world, very progressive ideas of French philosophy, French literature, and so on. Why Goethe Institute is, you know, such successful? Because he is doing the same thing. There only one point, example of, you know, rather different is Confucius Institute. It's a Chinese organization which is promoting Chinese mm-hmm. culture and so on. But it's extremely wealthy. It's very wealthy. It can pay for everything Chinese, you know, all over the world. So it's not the case of Russia. So how they will promote, you know, what samovar, vodka, what traditional values they want to sell? I don't know. Gagarin is suspicious in such, you know, context, traditionalist and conservative, because, you know, to fly to the space is, you know, very suspicious about when you speak about religion and so on. So I'm not joking. Where is the limit? Where is the border of this conservatism? Can you include, you know, Soviet experience to this conservatism? That is the question.
Well, and one has to wonder, whether this is just one of these latest trial balloon ideological projects. I mean, we don't talk so much about sovereign democracy anymore, although it used to be all the rage. Before we wrap up, I wanted to just leave it with this. The Kremlin spent, they obviously put some thought into rolling this thing out in retrospect. If you look at the events of last week, they spent some time thinking about rolling this out. I mean, you had the appointment of in three successive days. You had the appointment of Kisilyov and the announcement of the creation of Rossiya Sovetnya. You had the Center for Strategic Communications holding its press conference about releasing its report, Putin, the world conservative leader. And then you had Putin's, you know, chest thumping speech about defending family values worldwide. And then this week, you also had something that was very carefully rolled out. You had the amnesty, including, and remember, we were wondering whether it would or not, including Pussy Riot, some Bolotnaya protesters, and the Greenpeace activists. And then the surprise announcement on Thursday of Hodorkovsky's pardon. What two different weeks, two very different messages. What is Putin's game, Mark? What's he doing here?
I'd actually go back to what Kirill said right at the beginning of this podcast. Is in some ways an attempt to create this new political season, and I think it does link in not just with the sort of the pageantry of Sochi coming up, but also things like the reincarnation of the anti-corruption campaign, which again looks as if it's becoming, you know, being a little bit more serious and so forth. I mean, I think in some ways, because they do not have a single effective big idea to dominate the political scene, instead we're seeing them kind of creating a collage of different ways of kind of saying, look, actually, we need somehow to show that once again the Kremlin is back in business. You know, we have had, after all, in terms of domestic politics, essentially 2 years of drift.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't afford that. I mean, you can afford to do that when times are good, and you think times are going to continue to be good. It's clear that times are not going to be, you know, that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're trying to effectively patch together sort of, you know, Frankenstein's monster of a policy by, you know, a limb here and a leg there and an ear from somewhere else. And I think putting it all together, it makes it look as if it seems to be slightly incoherent. But I think that there is a single coherence. Mm-hmm. And that is the sense that the Kremlin is strong, the sense that the Kremlin has a moral center, a moral center that allows it to pardon some people because they're not important, but on the other hand, go after certain other, you know, undesirable social characteristics, shall we say. But most importantly of all, that the Kremlin is busy. The Kremlin is active. And, you know, obviously it's trying to build for itself the kind of media structure that will allow it to continue to maintain that sense that, in fact, the Kremlin is active and effective. It can't afford to have the kind of pretty unbiased scrutiny that RIA Novosti sort of gave it in the past.
Well, Kirill, last word to you. One of two very different weeks, two very different messages. Mark sees a Frankenstein monster being built here. What do you see?
It's a great temptation to say that it's a case of political schizophrenia. One week he's a bad conservative cop, and another week he's very good and
Tsar liberator.
Tsar liberator, and so on. So Nicholas the First and Alexander the Second, you know, at the same time. Another temptation is to say that Putin is trying to be nice to everyone. If we say,
I've never heard anybody say that.
Yes. But anyway, maybe, who knows? Maybe he's tired to be such, you know, to have such image. Now he wants to be just nice. But anyway, I think that this is the beginning of a new political season. And it just came to me that maybe, having in mind the upcoming economic difficulties, I'm not speaking again about crisis, I don't know, but speaking about forthcoming economical difficulties, maybe he's trying to establish a sort of new system to share the responsibility of all this future discomfort. Try to share responsibility among authority, himself, opposition, various parts of opposition, and maybe this imaginary whole conservative audience. Maybe to do something like this. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, we'll certainly have a lot to discuss on our year wrap-up podcast next week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me via Skype from London has been co-host Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. And also on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks, as always, gentlemen, for the enlightening, albeit chaotic, discussion.
My pleasure.
I'd like to also thank our brilliantly patient and patiently brilliant producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the totally cool Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week for our 2013 wrap-up. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.